It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The legacy of Frederick Douglass still reverberates through the conflicts that ripple through the Eastern Shore. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. In front of the Talbot County Courthouse stand two statues, one of Frederick Douglass, commissioned in 2011, and another called the Talbot Boys, of a young Confederate soldier erected just over 50 years after the Civil War. They stand 51 feet apart on either side of the walkway. David Blight has authored a new biography entitled Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, and he explores the development of Douglass from his early years as a slave to become one of the most recognizable leaders in 19th century America. We have David on the phone, and welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Don. Thanks much for having me.
So, first of all, describe for me the kind of world that Douglass was born in terms of what did the Eastern Shore look like? What was its structure? How endemic was slavery to this particular region?
Slavery was a pretty big deal on the Eastern Shore, especially in Talbot County and a bit further south, Dorchester County. Douglass was born, of course, out along the Tuckahoe River in probably his grandmother Betsy's cabin on what then was called the Home Hill Farm. It's just east of Easton. This wasn't the greatest soil, but it was good farming soil. And then he, of course, grew up in part, at least as a small boy, at the Y House, at the Great Y Plantation, which was the biggest property, the biggest slaveholding operation in all of Maryland, owned by the Lloyds. And there he would have experienced, he did experience, and he wrote poignantly about almost an industrial system of production on the many farms and thousands of acres of the Y Plantation. It was primarily tobacco and then grains, corn and wheat, for the market. There was very little cotton of any sort on the Eastern Shore, probably none. But slavery was a very big part of Eastern Shore antebellum economies, as was slave trading. That is, slaves that were sold away from the Eastern Shore south to Virginia and even south, further south to the Southwest slave trade. On the other hand, when he went to Baltimore, it was a different matter. But on the Eastern Shore, Douglass lived primarily among slaves, and occasionally he would have met a free black person, but he doesn't encounter free blacks in any significant way until he goes up to Baltimore.
And that's interesting because on the Eastern Shore, I know that there were actually various communities of free blacks. I think there's one particularly in Easton, and yet he seemed to be blocked off from that society.
He was, primarily because he's only only through age of six, almost seven, when he's taken by his grandmother to the Y Plantation. He lived a year, year and a half at the Y, and then he's sent to Baltimore when he's only seven, and he doesn't come back to the, well, he comes back to the Eastern Shore that first year to be divided up when Aaron Anthony died. That was his owner. And all of Anthony's slaves were divided up amongst his kinfolk. He was given to Thomas Auld, who then sent him back to Baltimore, which was one of Douglass's strokes of good luck. But he did not, in those years, spend any time to speak of at all in Easton. He will come back to the Eastern Shore as a teenager, and he will live primarily in St. Michael's, or on the land not far from St. Michael's, on Edward Covey's farm, and then on the Freeland farm, where he lived each place a year as a teenager. But he had very little experience with Easton. In fact, his experience with Easton, unfortunately, was when he was jailed after his aborted and failed escape plot on William Freeland's farm when he's about 18. He spent 2 weeks in the Easton County Jail, which is right there in the still existing Talbot County Courthouse. Right on the back of that courthouse is where the jail was, and that's where Douglass spent 2 weeks until Thomas Auld came in and told him he was almost miraculously sending him back to Baltimore and not selling him south. But he was just turned 18 when that happened.
So how did the experience at the Y plantation shape him? What was his experience like? What did he learn from that experience? As you say, it was only about 18 months.
Yeah, he learned a great deal, and he wrote quite lyrically about it in the autobiographies. He remembered that that's where he first has vivid memories, because he's 6, 7 years old. He has lots of memories of nature, blackbirds flying over him, which for him came symbols of freedom, the sounds of the Y plantation, the work life of the Y plantation. He writes also quite lyrically and even painfully about the differences between the house slaves who worked up in the big house and all the other slaves who were down in the quarters or out in the fields. He writes unforgettably about what he called allowance day, when all of the slaves from all over the various Y farms would come into the big house, or the environment of the big house. He called it the great house, and they would get their allowances of cornmeal and other goods, and even clothing. And that's where Douglas even remembers hearing the songs, slave songs, as people were walking toward the Y house. He also vividly remembers the stables and the carriage houses, and how he loved to go kind of play amongst the horses and the carriages. But perhaps most vividly, and this is what happens with our childhood memory, I think, he particularly remembers some of the vicious beatings he witnessed. He remembers seeing the old man who ran the stables forced to his knees and beaten by Colonel Lloyd himself. And then he remembers watching a slave woman named Nellie savagely beaten by an overseer. He remembers hearing the stories of a slave named Denby who gets killed in a runaway attempt. So he has tremendous traumatic memories of the Y plantation. At the same time, you know, he describes it various ways as both a kind of Eden-like place, he calls it that, but also a sort of prison. An Eden and a prison. And again, to read Douglas about the Y House plantation is a fascinating journey into just how one remembers childhood. And we all probably associate our memories with childhood with those events that were the most emotionally or physically riveting, experiences that leave emotional traces in the memory. That's how memory works. So the richness of his memories of his time at the Y, even though it wasn't a long period, is remarkable.
Did he have much interaction in terms of the White family, aside obviously from the beatings he saw from Lloyd? Did he have any friends or any connection? What was that like?
He didn't initially, no, but he does later. After the Civil War, when the famous Frederick Douglass returned to the Eastern Shore, he makes actually several returns to the Eastern Shore. One of them was to actually the Y Plantation, where, the direct descendant of Colonel Lloyd was at that point, I think, the grandson. That grandson chose not to be home that day and was off on business in Easton, as Douglas told it. And an 18-year-old son hosted him when Douglas literally visited the Y House, sat on the veranda, went into the house. It probably was the first time he ever set foot inside that house. He also brought a copy of The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass, his third autobiography, and left it at the house. And Richard Tillman and his wife, who live there now, who are themselves or one of them is a direct descendant of the Lloyds. They still have that copy of The Life and Times. He later developed closer relationships, actually, with the son and daughter of Thomas Auld, who was his second owner. But Auld did not live or work much of his time at the White House. Auld lived off in St. Michael's.
So he is now sent up to Baltimore. Tell me a little bit about how that occurred and what seemed, I think he describes, as sort of opening up an entire world that he did not realize even existed.
Yes, indeed. He eventually calls it his Baltimore dreams. He's first sent there when he's 7 years old to be the companion of a little boy named Tommy Auld, the white boy, who was the son of Sophia and Hugh Auld. Hugh Auld was Thomas Auld's brother. So here's his slave owner sending him to Baltimore to be the companion of his nephew. And that was the most important break, if you like, of Douglas's life, that is to live in Baltimore, where he attains literacy, possibly the most important possession Douglas ever had. He's in a major, major ocean port city at that point. Baltimore, as it still is, but then was a major maritime port, a major shipbuilding port. He eventually gets jobs down along the docks. And by the time he's a teenager, that's where he learns the trade of caulking, among other things. He gets into some tussles and some fights along the docks, too. But the city of Baltimore, in his two stints of living there, which added up to, I think, about 9 years of his 20 years as a slave, he lives about 11 of them on the Eastern Shore and about 9 of them in Baltimore, and two extensive stints, Baltimore became the place where he could see that there was a larger world, where he finds his path to literacy. He attends black and white churches. He meets lots of people in the free black community. In the year that Douglas escaped, in 1838, Baltimore had about 130,000 people, but only about 3,000 slaves, and yet about 17,000 free blacks. It was a very significant free black population with its own churches, its own alternative economies, and so on. And it's also in that community, somewhere when he was 18 or 19, when he appears to have met Anna Murray, the woman he would eventually marry, who would become his first wife. She was a free black woman, born right out on the Eastern Shore, just on the other side of the Tuckahoe, from Douglas, from where Douglas was born. And it's even possible that he and Anna, as children, she was about 3 years older, but it's possible they had played at that same mill on the Tuckahoe as kids, because that's where everybody went. Don't know that for sure. But he meets her in Baltimore in his late teenage years, and she plays a role in helping him escape when he's 20 years old.
Now, she seems almost strange in terms of a companion because she's illiterate. She's not someone who ultimately wound up being engaged politically and publicly, as certainly Douglas did. Do you have any sense about what attracted Douglas?
Well, it's hard to say entirely, except that when they meet, she's a young woman, early 20s by then, who works as a domestic in a white people's home. She has a job. She has a certain stability about her. She was, in all likelihood, quite involved in a local church. And Douglas probably would have met her at perhaps a church gathering. There was also a debating society that he got involved in Baltimore, in the free black community. At some kind of free black community gathering is probably where they met. And who is he at that point but a late teenage slave working down on the docks, dreaming his way out of Baltimore? He's not the world-class writer that we know him later. And he probably could have cared less that Anna didn't read or write yet. And she played a role when he escaped, more than a role. Her bravery was the same as his bravery, because she had her bags packed and waited for the letter to arrive that someone would have read to her. that Douglas had successfully escaped into New York City. And her bags were packed, and she took the same trains and the same ferry boats across the same rivers through the same 36-hour trek that he did and risked everything herself. If she'd have been caught doing this, her life, her livelihood, would have been in danger. So they arrive in New York. They're this young, frightened couple who obviously had fallen in love. They move up to New Bedford. They are going to have 5 children over the next decade. And he had himself a perfect companion. He had a helpmeet. He had a woman who would raise the children and keep a home. And that's what he desperately needed in those years. You know, like some other marriages, they grew into different people. Very
right.
Different people. And it is true that Anna remained largely a non-reader and non-writer the rest of her life. It is a difficult marriage over time. It is fraught with obstacles of many kinds. The most famous African-American writer, orator, intellectual by the 1850s, 60s, 70s is married to a woman who did not, in any deep way, share his public life. She almost never traveled with him. But she was clearly and obviously crucial in the raising of Douglas's 5 children, 4 of whom live to adulthood.
I wanted to ask you, by the way, there's probably a seminal event in his life, which is the confrontation with Edward Covey before, obviously, he's escaped. Describe that for me, and it seems as if he finds his own dignity, his own freedom, as it were, even within, obviously, the slave environment.
Yeah, it's certainly the way he writes about it. He was hired out by Thomas Auld in St. Michael's to Edward Covey, whose farm was only about 2 or at most 3 miles outside of St. Michael's. I think it's just west of there. For a better part of a year, when he's about 16. Going on 17. He's a rebellious youth by then. He remembers just never being fed enough. He doesn't want to work in Thomas Auld's kitchen, and he doesn't want to do anything they want him to do. He's been to Baltimore. He's seen the city. He's the kid who's been to the city. And now he's back on the Eastern Shore, and he's treated like a chattel. And so Auld can't handle him, and he hires him out to this Covey, who was known to be effective in correcting or breaking, if you like, rebellious slaves. And Douglas spent the better part of a year under Covey's control and Covey's whip until Douglas decided, according to the way he remembers it and tells it, to stand up to Covey one day, and he fought him in and around the barn on Covey's farm and bested Covey, according to Douglas. Beat the hell out of him, if you like. And after which, he says, Covey never laid a hand on him. Now, he constructs that as a writer. You got to remember, Douglas, when writing this up, has become a very self-conscious artist as a writer, and the way Douglas portrays that scene is as a kind of resurrection through violence, a very male story of, you know, recreating himself through the act of standing up and fighting Covey. At the end of that period, he is sent off to the Freeland farm up the road to a very different kind of hired master. Freeland never beat his slaves. Douglas was actually quite amazed at that. But there he just worked every day as a field hand in the fields. But that fight with Covey does become a kind of pivot of his autobiography, at least of his early life. He says famously, "I have shown you the way a man was made a slave. Let me now show you how a slave became a man."
Also, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the role of religion in his thinking? Because it seems to permeate, obviously, in all of his writings, all of his speakings, lots of biblical references. What came out of particularly for in terms of religion, in terms of his experience on the Eastern Shore?
Sure. Well, lots of things. He encounters preaching on the Eastern Shore as well as in Baltimore. But Thomas Auld also took him to camp meetings. And Douglas writes vividly about it. He took him along as an early teenager to these camp meetings, and he got to observe, and slaves were brought along. They didn't get to truly participate in the revival. They didn't get to make confession and do testimonies inside the circle, as it was known among Methodists. But he actually witnessed his own owner, Auld, undergo this personal testimony, coming to Jesus, weeping as he confesses his story. And it gave Douglas a tremendous sense of the hypocrisy or the potential hypocrisy of Christianity and of religion, how a slaveholder could kneel on his knees and weep for his sins and pray in front of everyone else and ask God's guidance and forgiveness and all the rest, and yet go right back the next day treating slaves as livestock, as property to be bought and sold. That's where Douglass's great sense of the contradictions and the terrible ironies of making humans into property came from. And one of his most famous speeches, when he goes on the circuit in the 1840s, is what became known as the Slaveholder's Sermon. And that's where Douglass would mimic a pro-slavery preacher in the South, and he'd heard a few. He knew this performance when slaveholding preachers would get up and say, "Slaves, be loyal to your masters." They would quote from those sections of the Bible that appealed to slaves to be loyal to their masters, and then he would spin that into a vicious critique of the hypocrisy of Christianity, the hypocrisy of slaveholding Christians. But then he's also heard the Bible so much, and especially when he gets to Baltimore is where he starts reading it, and reading it carefully. Eventually with an old black preacher named Charles Lawson, who he makes a big deal of in the narrative, a kind of a storefront preacher who worked as a drayman by day but loved his Bible, especially the Old Testament. And once he discovered this teenage kid who could really read well, he would sit with Douglas, and Douglas would just read out loud whole sections of Old Testament stories with Lawson. And that's how Douglas started to get language into his head. It's from the King James language of both Old and New Testament. And he attended churches in Baltimore, four of them that he names. He even describes the preachers and what he liked about them and didn't like about them. So he's pretty well steeped in the Bible as literature, as storytelling, before he even escapes from slavery.
Now, obviously, he had a relationship with Abraham Lincoln, and obviously Lincoln changes over time, the Emancipation Proclamation and so on, and he seems to see his country changing. Yes. But it's not until, I think it's 1876, I think, that he actually finds himself returning to the Eastern Shore. Tell me a little bit about that, and was there a change in Douglas in terms of how he viewed slavery, how he viewed where the country was at the time, and his own, personally, his own time?
Oh, sure. There's a lot of change. It's actually 77 when he first returns.
Yes, right.
I think it's the fall of 1877. It's after the disputed election of 1876 and the Compromise of 77. And the relative so-called end of Reconstruction. His views changed. He never could quite forgive, if you like, slaveholders or slavery for forging his own soul. But of course, the The war was now 10 and 12 years in the past. Emancipation had become the great pivot of his history and of the nation's history. By that time, he first returns to the Eastern Shore in 77, though he's deeply, deeply worried about the retreat from and the abandonment of Reconstruction. But he still holds on to that idea that the great triumph of emancipation in the Civil War had given the United States a chance to totally reinvent itself, to recreate a second American Republic and a second Constitution, and he believed they had in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. He's worried that that's all being eroded and washed away by the Southern Democrats and by terror and violence. But he does go visit, and that may be where you were leading here.
Right.
It's very important. He goes back in part that first time to visit Thomas Auld, who he believed was on his deathbed. He was very ill in St. Michael's. And when Douglas returned, he had the press in tow with him. You know, he was this famous former slave returning to meet his actual owner. I mean, that's a big news event. And he did meet Auld. Auld was bedridden, and they spent 20 or 25 minutes together, we believe. And it's apparent, it's more than likely, that Douglas went there in part to basically ask Auld, "Are you my father?"
Hmm.
Because Douglas never knew who his father was. He always knew his father was white and probably one of his owners, but he never knew for sure. And he spent a lot of energy and time trying to figure it out. And if Auld had told him yes, then Douglas would have told us. So he didn't get a yes out of Auld. What he did get out of Auld is Auld told him he thought when he had been born, because Douglas didn't even know that. Douglas thought he was born in 1817. He was actually born in 1818. And Auld told him that day that he believed it was 1818. Now, the fact that Auld would know that is curious in itself. But he was always in search of who he was and where he was from. This is why the Eastern Shore is so important, not only in forging Douglas, but also in his long life. He returns, either physically or in his imagination, to try to explain, how did I come from there to here? How did I go from that side of the Chesapeake to this side of the Chesapeake? How did I get from that bend in the Tuckahoe to my big house in Anacostia in Washington, D.C.? How did I get from there to here? It's always what he's trying to understand about himself. And by the way, it's in my book. I found one of the most moving stories of his return to the Eastern Shore is that first visit, 1877, it's November, I think. He visits Auld in St. Michael's, but then the following day he's over in Easton. He gave speeches at two churches, black churches. Then he hired a carriage that just took him out east of town, took him out to the Tuckahoe. And he walked back through that field, and he found the little ravine that he remembered, which was right where he remembered his grandma's cabin being, right? The little ravine that came up from the river, which is still there. And he tells us that he even looked for a certain cedar tree that he thought he remembered. And then he knelt on hand and knee, and he scooped up handfuls of soil, put it in a bag, and took it back to Washington with him, as though he was simply trying to take a piece of the Eastern Shore to the Western Shore, and, you know, to always sort of hang on to who he was. And emotionally and in his memory, he's also still searching for his mother. Who was she? You know, where is she? Searching for his father. He doesn't even really know who it is. We all do that to some degree, probably. We tend to return, at least in our minds, to the places we're from to try to figure out who we are.
Finally, he writes three autobiographies, and some have suggested that as he moves through time, that he begins to soften in terms of the slave owners and his experience with them. Do you think that's true? And B, what do you think was happening there for him?
To an extent, he softened, but only to an extent. He tells us, for example, when he met Auld in 77, that they both wept. They shook hands. They shared a story or two. He tells us that Auld called him Marshall Douglas, because at that point he had been appointed Marshal of the District of Columbia. And Douglas told Auld, no, I'm just Frederick to you, and so on. It led to a certain, there were a couple press reports that said Douglas had kneeled in front of Auld and all of this. That's not true. But, yeah, he's growing older. He's trying to understand what's happened to himself and what's happened to the country. For that matter, what's happened to Maryland. But one should never assume that he somehow softened on the problem of slavery or the slavery question. He found it very, very hard to forgive what had been done to him. Doesn't mean that he didn't feel in his mind and heart the dilemmas of the slaveholders themselves. In fact, if anyone carefully reads Douglass's narrative, the first autobiography or the second, My Bondage and My Freedom, one of the main themes of those two autobiographies are his portraits of the slaveholder's mind, of how they were trapped in this system. They grew up in this system, they were trapped in this system, and most of them knew no way to imagine their way out. So he had a certain distance and sympathy for their dilemma. At the same time, he of course wanted their society and their structure crushed, and it was in the war, and he was, rest assured, very glad of that.
We've been speaking with David Blight. He is author of a new biography entitled Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, and we appreciate you taking our time to speak with us this morning.
Well, thank you, Don. It's always great to connect with the Eastern Shore.
Thank you. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 may have brought the Union to the breaking point. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. As the nation inched closer and closer to the outbreak of the Civil War, the act clearly marked the last stop in efforts by Henry Clay and others to avert the violent breakup of the nation. But it also came at a time when the Underground Railroad was in full gear, and resistance in the North was mounting to slavery in the South. Slaves themselves were making their escapes with ever more daring efforts, and with leaders such as Harriet Tubman, the most famous conductor on the Eastern Shore. Richard Blackett has written a new book entitled The Captive's Quest for Freedom, Fugitive Slaves, the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, and the Politics of Slavery. And he gives special emphasis to those who sought freedom and resisted. Blackett is also an Andrew Jackson Professor of History at Vanderbilt University and a historian of the abolitionist movement. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's start, I guess, at the beginning, which is embedded in the U.S. Constitution, is the idea that there's an obligation to return slaves. Tell me a little bit about that and the fact that it doesn't really use the word slave.
No, it doesn't. But the idea was, is that, or at least it was believed, that this was one of the reasons. Had it not been included, that the Constitution would not have happened, that the country would not have come together in those trying times. So this decision that slaves must be returned was seen as one of the pillars of the first great compromise over slavery. And it is embedded in the Constitution. And it required, as a sort of enabling act, the passage years later, in 1793, of the first Fugitive Slave Act that would implement this constitutional requirement. And that act would stay in place, although attempts were made between 1793 and the middle of the 19th century to make it more draconian, to make it more enforceable. But those efforts never came to fruit. So in 1850, this becomes really the second attempt to put some teeth into this constitutional requirement.
So what did the 1793 Fugitive Act actually require?
Well, it did. It implemented, it put in place the mechanisms for enforcing that constitutional requirement. But the problem was that it left it up largely up to the states to enforce it. And the states slowly over the years devised ways to get around that federal requirement. And there was a great Supreme Court ruling, a major Supreme Court ruling in 1842. We don't need to get into the kind of technicalities right. of these things, but what it basically said is that the law, the federal law is superior to state law, and the federal law had to be enforced, but the states did not have to go out of their way to help in the enforcement of the act, which of course gave the states the option of devising ways to resist enforcement of the law.
In some ways, it reminds me of the claim for states' rights.
Yes, but the irony of it is that it's the South that always claimed states' right until it came to this issue when they insisted that it was a national responsibility.
So moving towards 1850, and as I indicated, it seems like it's almost the last stop, really. I mean, for the entire first half of the 19th century, we see political figures with Henry Clay, John C. Calhoun, Daniel Webster, all those people struggling to figure out how to create a compromise to keep the country together while trying to address the issue of slavery. What is it about the 1850 compromise and this Fugitive Slave Act that seems like it's just the last stop, that after that, there's no going back?
Well, it was Clay's and... Clay is the sort of engine behind this. I mean, he is the one that came up with... The compromise has a number of features that try to address pressing questions that arose out of the United States acquisition of all that Mexican territory after the Mexican-American War. And one of the issues that arose is, are slaveholders going to be permitted to take their slaves into this new federal territory? And there's an earlier compromise in 1820 that's known as the Missouri Compromise, in which it was stated explicitly a line was drawn beyond which slavery could not be permitted. Now, with the new territory acquired, the issue is what this line no longer holds, at least for slaveholders. So Calhoun's compromises... which, by the way, included the abolition of the slave trade in Washington, D.C., was an attempt to address these larger issues. And at the same time, he saw this fugitive slave law as a way to as not a sop to the South, but a gesture to the South that the nation was, that the country was committed to enforcement of this constitutional requirement. And what it did, in effect, was nationalize the issue of slavery. The recapture of slaves now became a national obligation in the sense, and mechanisms are provided that the nation would now be responsible for enforcing, the federal government would be responsible for enforcing it. So it created commissioners. The cost of returning fugitive slaves would be borne by the federal treasury, and there are another number of other features that sort of nationalize this issue.
Before we get into some of the detail there, why was it that about the expansion of the country that the South felt threatened? I mean, I think at one point, I think 1860, I think it was, or 61, there, I think I've read where Lincoln might have been amenable to allowing slavery to continue to exist in the South, but no expansion. There were lots of talk about it. What was it? Why did the South not say, okay, I'm going to cut my losses?
You were going to cut, because politically it would have, it made them very vulnerable. Because under the organization, under the political organization of the country, any new state that comes in and comes in as a free state gets two senators. It unbalances the whole political equilibrium. That's how the South saw it. And that crazy business of the Electoral College and also counting black slaves as portions of a human being for voting purposes. Those were all compromises that attempted to maintain a balance between free states and slave states. So that if this new compromise, if slaves were not, if the line of the Missouri Compromise was not withdrawn, it creates a problem, a political crisis for many.
So let's go back a little. And one of the things that I mentioned a moment ago was this idea that, that the anti-slavery movement really seems to be pick up steam, particularly as we start heading into 1850. But it's been growing for a while. Mm-hmm. What are the dynamics of that movement that creates this movement towards a stronger sense of abolition?
The compromise of the fugitive slave law for many is the problem with the compromise. The nature of the law and its requirements are simply unacceptable to most people. It violated basic legal traditions. There was no habeas corpus. There was no right to a jury by trial. The fugitive slaves, the suspected fugitive slave, could not testify in his or her behalf. There were all kinds of things in this law that simply violated traditional legal ways of the country, the way the country had always operated, and therefore it, for many, it was unacceptable, and it provided for those who were opposed to slavery an opportunity to express their disdain for the law and for those who were promoting slavery, as the law expressed it. So that became, in addition, there's a rise in, if one looks at slave escapes in the late 1840s, there seems to be, if not a rising tide of escapes, although there were, particularly from the border states, there are dramatic escapes that are taking place, the kind of escapes that drives slaveholders, proponents of slavery, wrong the bend, and at the same time provide abolitionists with kind of political fodder. One can think of Henry Boxbrown's Escape in a Box, mail from Richmond to Philadelphia. The William and Ellen Craft escaping from Georgia. Those were dramatic escapes that caught the attention of the country, and abolitionists promoted them to show that the determination of the enslaved to be free. So that is the kind of political backdrop. And all of these things that happen, those two cases happened before 1850. And escapes are taking place, particularly if what historians have found is that there's an increasing number of group escapes in the late 1840s, not just individuals running away, but groups of people running away, families running away. So there's a growing sense that there's a crisis here that is brewing. And for those who supported the fugitive slave law, they wanted to nip this in the bud, one. And they made it, it became a symbol in their argument as they saw it as the last best hope of keeping the country together. Because for Northern politicians to vote for this law was be an expression of their commitment to the constitutional requirements.
What kind of role do people like Frederick Douglass or Harriet Tubman or Sojourner Truth, for that matter, play in this sort of breaking of the straw, as it were, in terms of the shift out of heading towards the Civil War? I mean, they were prominent figures. I mean, Frederick Douglass in particular was a major figure. Mm-hmm. What kind of role did they play?
Well, Frederick Douglass is the great propagandist. I mean, there's no better one in this period. Harriet Tubman is the person who is in the trenches. And she is doing things that nobody had seen. I mean, they couldn't quite comprehend what she was doing, and they seemed to have no ability to stem to disrupt what she was doing. But I think more importantly is the fact that individual slaves and individual families took the bit between the teeth and decided to do what they had to do to get away from slavery. And it is that rising tide that Douglass is able to exploit. Keep in mind, Douglass is safe. Not only is he safe, he's also a free man. Harriet Tubman is in the trenches, and she's fighting the good fight. But those unnamed individual slaves who are escaping in significant numbers in this period from all across the divide between slavery and freedom are the ones that are really driving this resistance.
Would you say that the South at this period of time is basically losing control?
No, they have incredible power to resist and to enforce this law. No. It is the slaves, those who are escaping, that are swimming against the tide. Whenever slaves are brought before officials, federal officials, they're returned in many instances. But there were significant instances where that did not happen. And that raises the political temperature. In addition, what we have come to know is that slaves were escaping in numbers that not even the system could comprehend. They couldn't deal with it. The mechanisms they had in place were not there to deal. But they simply, by escaping, they avoided the law. They avoided the enforcement of the law. But nonetheless, it was clear that they were escaping. All you have to do is just look at.
I mean, the reason why I ask is that it seems to me that the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 is an attempt to rein this in, and mm-hmm. and even then I suspect it wasn't as effective as perhaps they
it
would like.
It was a bad law.
Yeah.
It was an indefensible law. That is what made it so for many people so unacceptable. It just violated all sorts of principles. It stacked the deck. It created mechanisms for enforcement that more importantly, it made potential slave catchers of every single citizen from a northern state. Because under the law, if the authorities ask you to help them catch a suspected fugitive slave, you are obligated to do it on penalty of a fine that was simply exorbitant. So even for people who were indifferent to slavery, they could look at this and say, why am I being forced to participate in this? If it's your system, if you want it, you could keep it, but I'm not trying to promote its abandonment, but nonetheless, I don't see why I should be part of this. So that is also one of the problems with the law.
By the way, there's also personal liberty laws. How do those fit into this?
Well, the personal liberty laws were just meant to impede the enforcement. So, for instance, let me take Pennsylvania again. There's a law in 1847 that says the authorities cannot use state prisons to hold suspected fugitive slaves. That means at a time when there were no federal prisons, where was a slaveholder who was going to Harrisburg or someplace and recaptured his slaves, and who the commissioner says you can return your slave, now has to sit in Harrisburg for a night waiting to catch the train to return, say, to Virginia or someplace. Where does he house this recaptured slave? And this meant that the black community could exploit this loophole. And they did very effectively because the slaveholder was under enormous pressure and his agent is under enormous pressure. There's one famous incident where the slaveholder put up in a local hotel with his with his remanded slave, and the folks burnt the hotel down. So I mean, those kinds of things, and that creates a real problem for those people who are trying to enforce the law.
So, what kind of role did the gangs who were involved in returning slaves play in all of this? I mean, we had some notorious folks certainly on the Eastern Shore. Paddy Cannon is probably the most infamous, but there were others as well. I guess was it George Alberti? I guess. What kind of role did they play in all of this?
That tends to be a bit earlier than the 85th. Patty is a bit earlier.
She died, I think, early.
Yeah, it's a bit early. So the gangs don't seem to be very central to this struggle in places like the Eastern Shore. Where they play a significant role is places across the board, the state line into Pennsylvania, where there are gangs there who are simply criminal gangs, and one of their enterprises is to return fugitive slaves. But these are the same people who are stealing cows and who are kidnapping people and doing all sorts of things. So, but gangs are not very, very central in the Eastern Shore. When crises arose in the Eastern Shore, they tended to be community-based crises rather than simply run by a particular gang.
Such
of
as?
People. Well, I think, for instance, of the case of Burroughs, who was caught taking a number of fugitive slaves out of... Now, it's in that situation where the community comes together and says to Burroughs, you have to leave. You can't stay here. And the man defies it after a while, but nonetheless, they run him out on a rail. So it is those kinds of things. And I suppose at the heart of that kind of community resistance to these abolitionist activities is our gangs, but it's hard to identify who they are.
Also, there was an effort during this period in the first half of the century to colonize African Americans back in Africa. Henry Clay, as a matter of fact, was a big proponent of this, as were a number of leaders. How does that fit into this, how people looked at slavery? And Lincoln, for that matter, was supportive of that idea as well.
Yeah.
But it didn't go over. I mean, I know Frederick Douglass, for instance, said, we're Americans. No. Sorry.
No. Okay. There's a in the wake of the passage of the 1850 law, there's a resurgence in colonization. Those people who were promoting colonization, like Clay, I mean, the man who proposes the compromise is the same man who is still very active and has been active since the inception of colonization back in 1816. So the idea, as Douglas would articulate it in his usual very crisp way, is that the idea of the fugitive slave law is to return slaves, to get fugitives out of the North back into slavery, and the idea of the colonization is to get free blacks out of the United States. In that way, what they do is what it would do simply, as opponents of colonization have argued, is that it reinforces the slave system. You have a resurgence of interest in colonization. Many of the people who were involved, who were administrators and sort of functionaries of the Whig government of 1850, were also colonizationists. In fact, the man who was the head of the Treasury, who was dispensing money for the return of fugitive slaves, is a prominent proponent of colonization. So you have those two things coming together. And in the midst of this struggle, what it does is it says to free blacks, an important part of this discussion, is that they are no longer, they're not needed here, they're not supposed to be here, they should go somewhere else, to a place where that is appropriate to their constitution. So what you get then is a resurgence of interest in colonization, and what that does is that in alienating free blacks, it also raises the question among many free blacks of whether or not they belong or should stay here.
Although there was not a great response. I mean, I think mentioned like, what, maybe 1,000, something like that?
Colonization was never a large. But what it is important politically, though, because it creates this tension Because one of the things is that inheres in the crisis over the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850 is the fact that because it doesn't have any of the legal protections that law should afford us, is that it meant that free blacks, a person who is picked up, who is a free black, has no way of defending himself because he cannot testify. He cannot call in counsel to protect him. So that what we see also in the wake of the 1850 law is a spike in kidnapping of free blacks who are sold south, particularly from, again, places close to the border, the state line, the borders between slavery and freedom.
Tell me the role of women in this resistance to slavery.
That one is hard to pinpoint, although all the reports show that they are ever present. Anytime a hearing comes about, they are there. They make their presence felt, blacks and whites. Lucretia Mott, for instance, the famous Pennsylvania abolitionist, turns up at every single hearing. And she sits in the hearing room in a place that makes it quite clear to the commissioner that she is there for only one purpose. And black women are outside of the courtroom, and in some cases they are inside the hearing room, and they pack the hearing room in a sort of solidarity with. And many instances they lead the charge of when fugitive slaves are rescued, they're there as well. But they are not always easily identifiable. But the records, the reports of cases in newspapers show that they are ever present.
What's the impact, by the way, in all of this in terms of both John Brown and his action, as well as Nat Turner, these sort of violent efforts to free slaves in some fashion or another, and particularly on the Southern psyche?
Well, I think in the case of John Brown, that is just another example for many to show that the country had gone mad, that this abolitionist thing is out of control and needs to be controlled. But John Brown is not really germane to this discussion about the fugitive slaves. Those two things are happening separately, but their impact collectively, I think, is clear.
And Dred Scott decision? I mean, it seems to be like the last legal stop before.
Yeah, well, again, Dred Scott. I mean, there are those pivotal moments in the 1850, and Dred Scott is one of them. And the ruling of Dred Scott, of course, is that blacks have no rights, and they were never citizens, and never considered part of the country. And as such, therefore, it's very important politically. But as far as the struggle against the fugitive slave law, it's not part of that kind of general discussion.
As the country headed towards 1860, the sense I get was that people began to feel as if that there was no peaceful resolution. I'm particularly reminded of actually Harry Beecher Stowe, who wrote actually a book a few years after Uncle Tom's Cabin called Dread, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the novel, you get this sense that slavery is so embedded, particularly in the South, it cannot be extracted. And it's so embedded that even whites who do not own blacks, do not own slaves, are so invested in this system, I mean, that it could not be rooted out. I mean, do you think that's true? And do you think there was just no way out of this thing?
Well, that has always been one of the dilemmas that historians try to unravel, whether or not this was the country had gone down a path from which it couldn't retreat. Things were impossible to resolve. Because on the one hand, there are those who are saying that The only way that you can resolve this problem is A, enforce the law, get rid of all the personal liberties laws, stop trying to impede the rights of slaveholders, and then everything would be hunky-dory. There'd be no problems. On the other hand, people like Lincoln, and Lincoln comes to embody this, that there's to be no more slave territory. It is fixed, and any land acquisition, particularly in the case after the Mexican-American War, this should be land that is set aside for free labor, and by that they meant free white labor, and not have slave the slavery. And so there are two contending and clashing interests here that make it impossible to resolve for many. So it seems as though the country is marching towards. But I don't like to. As a historian, I'm interested in what is happening at a particular period of time, and I don't want to look at the 1850s and say, "Aha!" What we can see looking back is that the country is moving inexorably towards a civil war. I don't think that's how it works. But by 1860, with the election of Lincoln, it's clear that for many in the South, that's the straw that broke the camel's back.
Because it does seem as you look at that long debate over slavery that the struggle was so intense in terms of these two competing forces, particularly the development of the North, that something had to give, and it does not seem that the legal option, this idea, would ever pan out for. I mean, because some people have suggested, well, if Civil War had not occurred, that slavery would have died out. I'm rather skeptical about that, given the embeddedness of the institution. I mean,
In 1850, people who reluctantly voted in favor of the law say, look, this is the last chance. This is how you prove. And those people who were promoting the law from northern states said, look, we have to vote for this because we have to send a message to our fellow Americans in the South that really we are committed to the Constitution. So there was that sense that this might have been the last best hope to address this question. The fact that people, the slaves themselves, were not part of this discussion threw a kibosh in the works. They said by continuing to escape, they kept the temperature rising. So I think that is absolutely critical to understand that. But on the other hand, in the long sweep of American history, America has always got itself twisted over the issue of race. And it seems, and it gets itself at certain points in that to seem incapable of addressing the question in any rational, reasoned way. And this is another one of those examples. And then there are moments when they come close to addressing the higher principles on which the country is based. And then they retreat from it. And so this is one period, that decade of the 1850s is one period where they seem to be galloping towards disaster because of the political inability to address, to live up to the principles that they say drives the country. So if you have a country that is, and this is one of the uniquely American dilemmas. If you have a country that is based on these high vaunted principles of liberty for all and equality for all, the Declaration of Independence must be the most revolutionary statement that has ever been articulated. And then you proceed to have a constitution that violates that. Then you have set yourself on a course that becomes very, very difficult to resolve. So on the one hand, a free country in which slavery exists. That is a very, very difficult thing to pull off. And as a historian, you look at it and you see the periods when they really try to address it after the Civil War, for instance, and then Reconstruction collapses. We get to the Civil Rights Movement. It's there again. And for many of us, we think with the long arc of history, we think we're in a period of retreat again. Mm-hmm. But always over this issue of simply living up to your principles. Yeah.
We've been speaking with Richard Blackett. He has written a new book entitled The Captive's Quest for Freedom, Fugitive Slaves, the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law and the Politics of Slavery. And he is also an Andrew Jackson Professor of History at Vanderbilt University and a historian of the abolitionist movement. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
It's been a joy. Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.